are Locked On Timberwolves, your daily Minnesota Timberwolves podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Locked On Wolves podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. My name is Ben Beacon. I'm the host of Locked On Wolves. Happy Tuesday, everybody. Happy Timberwolves game day after the Wolves had Monday off. Today, we're going to spend most of the episode previewing the Wolves-Pelicans matchup on Tuesday night, taking a look at what to expect when the two teams take the floor against each other for only the second time this season. They only played the one time back in December. We'll talk briefly about that, although basically nobody on the Wolves played in that game that's currently on the team, so there's not a whole lot we can take from it in terms of the matchup. First, however, I did want to hit on a couple of general Wolves notes and spend a couple of minutes there. But first of all, a quick reminder, please subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google, wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Locked On T-Wolves. That's at Locked On T-Wolves. Don't forget the T. So a couple of Wolves notes from the weekend. We didn't, on Monday's episode, talk about the Allen Crabbe buyout. That happened on Saturday, I guess it was. And the Wolves bought Crabbe out in time so that he can sign with a team that's playoff eligible. This wasn't really on anyone's radar except for he had missed the past few games due to personal reasons. So I guess piecing things together, not all that surprising. Crabbe was, of course, never really all that comfortable on the Wolves. He did not have much success at all. Of course, he hadn't really played well this season in Atlanta either. The Wolves were, in a sense, taking a flyer. Crabbe himself, with the Wolves, he played in nine games. He shot only 23.1% from beyond the arc, which, of course, let's see. So he was 6 of 26 total, 32% from the floor, and just wasn't effective. He was kind of on the fringes of the rotation, played 14 and a half minutes a game. And with the Wolves wanting to give some more time to like Keelan Martin, potentially Jalen Noel moving forward, the Wolves did him a solid in a sense. The initial thought was that the Wolves were trying to get under the luxury tax threshold, which was a fair assumption with a move like this. We didn't know for sure until Monday. And then the news came down that the Wolves actually did not get under the threshold. It looks like Crabbe gave up just under $700,000 in his buyout agreement with the Wolves, and they are not quite below the threshold, unfortunately. It looks like the Wolves are still about $454,000 over the tax. So obviously, if the Wolves are trying to get under the tax, it's going to be difficult to do that now. They could still buy out Evan Turner, but that March 1st deadline has passed, which means that if Turner is bought out, he's not going to be playoff eligible. So the Wolves, it might still be an incentive for them to get under the tax, but Turner doesn't really have an incentive to do it. He may as well just keep making the money he's making, not playing with the Wolves. At this point, it seems even more unlikely. It's more likely that he's bought than that or bought out than he actually plays in a game for the Wolves. So kind of a weird spot. Another option that's noted at hoopsrumors.com, they mentioned that the Timberwolves could cut a little used player who's likely to be claimed on waivers to try and get below the line, similar to what Miami did with Rodney Magruder last year. I don't see the Wolves doing that. The Wolves don't have any young talent that they'd be willing to just forfeit for the hopes that somebody claims them on waivers. And none of the veteran type guys are either A, going to get cut because the Wolves don't want to cut them, and B, they wouldn't necessarily be claimed off waivers. So it would be a surprise to see the Wolves go about it that way. And at this point, it seems like they're just going to have to pay the tax, which, isn't the end of the world. They're not over by a ton, but it's probably not how Glenn Taylor ideally would be operating in his mind for sure. So thought that was interesting. One other note on Crabbe. I think the only thing that really frustrates me about this, the Crabbe saga, if you will, which is maybe a little bit dramatic to call it that, but I guess the only thing that really bothers me is that Jeff Teague's expiring contract was essentially wasted, and we don't know for sure how much of an asset it was and if the Wolves could have held on to Teague a little bit longer. Remember, Teague was traded with Trevion Graham roughly a month before the trade deadline, so could the Wolves have used the Teague contract in a bigger deal, done something differently with it, versus taking back a guy that they ultimately cut 6 weeks later? I mean, maybe, probably. But I think the Wolves were also trying to change the culture and change the flow of their offense, getting really in the weeds with it. Jeff Teague is a ball stopper, a point guard that didn't fit the system. And I think that this was as much of getting Teague off the roster as it was using his contract as an asset. And I think that's probably a little bit of a mistake. We'll never know what else was out there in terms of what the Wolves could have done with Teague's contract. But it does feel as though the Wolves kind of burned through an asset in that sense and probably could have done more with it. Crabbe wasn't simply a flyer. He was kind of a flyer, but he wasn't simply, you know, just this contract to allow to expire because they could have done that with Teague. The idea was more that Crabbe was a guy who could fit into the Wolves system. He had played for Pablo Prigioni in Brooklyn. He had played for David Vanterpool in Portland, and he should have fit the system. He should have been okay on defense. He should have made three-pointers within the system. And then also, as Gerson Rosas touted shortly after the trade, the Wolves would then have Crabbe's bird rights. And so he was excited for the opportunity to potentially retain Crabbe in the offseason. Obviously, that's not happening now. They no longer have his bird rights. So interesting that the Wolves just kind of forfeited all that to try and get closer to the tax and not actually get out of the tax and accommodate Crabbe in a sense to allow him to sign with a playoff team. So interesting. Interesting all the way around. I think probably the first example of the misuse of an asset from Gerson Rosas and his regime, but still an interesting development nonetheless. Okay, a couple of other Wolves notes. Gerson Rosas, of course, I think we mentioned this on the podcast after last Wednesday's win over Miami. Rosas retweeted a tweet from the Timberwolves official account and said, "Tank that," was the exact quote from Gerson Rosas. Obviously, the word out there in NBA circles is that the Wolves are taking it really easy with Towns wrist, that they're not putting the most competitive lineup on the floor and trying to win. It seems a little silly to me because outside of Towns sitting out, what are the Wolves doing to tank? I mean, the rotations haven't been like ultra suspicious. They aren't. I mean, Jake Lehman's back. He's playing, right? Like, it's not like the Wolves are overtly tanking. I guess D'Angelo Russell did sit out the one game in Denver that the Wolves were fined for. If Towns has a fractured wrist, he has a fractured wrist. They're not going to push their franchise player to play with a fractured wrist when they're however many games out of the playoffs and headed for a top five draft pick anyways. It's not like they were winning with Towns on the floor. So the tanking thing to me seems a little weird. I even saw it from, there were a couple local writers that talked about it recently as if it was obvious they're tanking. And like, sure, if you consider valuing rest and recovery over putting all of your best players on the floor playing injured at this stage in a lost season, tanking, sure, but it's not like there's any overt tanking going on. Resting a star on the front end of a back-to-back like the Wolves did, if it was technically against the rules because they did it on a technically nationally televised game at NBA TV, fine, but it wasn't exactly an overt example of tanking. So all that to say, we talked about the fine after it happened. I think that was Friday's episode. But Rosas went out and talked to Chris Hine of the Star Tribune and gave several quotes about how he doesn't like the tanking talk. He thinks that it's unfair to the coaches and unfair to the players. Went into some detail about, basically the entirety of the roster coming from multiple different teams and everybody having different backgrounds and systems they've been playing in and how difficult that is, which I thought was really interesting that Rosas is going so public with this. I think it's not only a defense of the front office, but he's also trying to get out in front of, you know, defending the coach, defending the players. And I mean, most front offices would not go out and be super public about, no, we're not tanking, we're trying to win. And Rosas went out of his way to give this interview to make that really clear. So I think that speaks a lot to leadership for Rosas and also what he's trying to do in the public persona he's putting out there. And I think it's probably the right move. But I just thought that was interesting. Then one other note before we get a little bit into more of the on-court nuts and bolts, I thought this was really funny. Also from Chris Hine of the Star Tribune, he talked a little bit about how James Johnson is doing a lot from a leadership perspective for this team. And I think that's something that the Wolves were expecting when they acquired Johnson. Remember, Johnson's been with Miami now for the last few years, but he's been around the league a little bit and generally has a pretty positive reputation in terms of how hard he plays and his locker room presence. And Okogie's quote about James Johnson was, and this is from Chris Hine at the Star Trib, quote, "If James told me to jump off a cliff, I would do it yesterday. He's been great for us and we've been following his lead," end quote. That's a pretty awesome endorsement of Johnson's leadership ability. And to hear that from Josh Okogie too, who's a guy who tries to lead by example and is suddenly the guy that's been around this team the longest outside of Towns. Really interesting quote from Okogie. He's had some good ones in the media lately. He had made a comment about after the Wolves win the other night against Miami about teasing D'Angelo Russell about his defense and how they're giving Russell a hard time and trying to encourage him by making fun of his defense. So I think Okogie is taking a little bit of a leadership role as well. And I think that's really good to see. And Josh is obviously a guy that plays super hard and leads by example on the floor. So that's definitely important. All right, next up, I want to cover a note about the Wolves rotations and something that they've tried a little bit recently and apparently are going to try more in the future to shake things up a little bit, and then also get into the weeds on the Pelicans-Wolves matchup as well. The Timberwolves have been playing a little bit with the rotation lately, and they've had to get a little bit creative with Karl-Anthony Towns not available lately. But something that was noted by actually at the Star Tribune also, this time not by Chris Hine, but by Kent Youngblood, was that the Timberwolves are considering playing D'Angelo Russell and Jordan McLaughlin together more often moving forward. And so that got me thinking a little bit. They did it the other night. It worked a little bit in Miami. They tried it in Orlando. It did not seem to work as well. But I guess first, before we get into the numbers and what we've seen so far, the note from Kent Youngblood is basically that the Wolves think that they can be a lot more dynamic having two ball handlers on the floor at once. It allows D'Angelo Russell to play off the ball a little bit more. And what we know about D'Angelo Russell is he played the first part of his career, he largely played off the ball. I think he was a little bit miscast at times doing that. And he's been more ball dominant recently, certainly in Brooklyn, and that's kind of what he was doing when he emerged. However, he's been a good enough shooter overall, and especially in Minnesota, and really over the last couple of years, that he can play off the ball and be a pretty good catch and shoot player. And the one thing that concerns me is he's such a dynamic passer, and he's not exactly a cutter. I mean, he's mostly going to be a spot up type guy. If he's going to be off the ball, he doesn't score in the paint very much. He doesn't draw a ton of fouls. The only advantage really is that you're getting two ball handlers on the open floor, and it allows Jordan McLaughlin to probe a little bit and potentially kick out to a guy like Russell for an open shot, which I think if you believe in McLaughlin's ability to get into the paint and distribute, then that makes some sense because Russell is a good three-point shooter. And then that still allows you the ability, if McLaughlin drives and kicks, then Russell can also, you know, drive to the rim right behind him because he has that capability. It's just not his preferred style of offense. Russell would much rather be pulling up for a mid-range jumper or shooting a three-pointer than getting all the way to the rim. But it does make the offense a little bit more dynamic. It's not like the Wolves have tons of guys who can create off the dribble, and it puts probably their two best creators off the dribble in the game at the same time. Now, that's part of the issue. If McLaughlin's your second best creator off the dribble, I mean, it means that you have some roster talent issues a little bit. As good as McLaughlin plays, he shouldn't be one of the top two ball handlers on your team. Malik Beasley has the capability to be a creator. He has obviously athletic ability and the overall basketball talent to be a guy that can get in the paint, distribute, or score at the rim, draw fouls. But he, to this point, has been much better as a catch and shoot player. He's good in transition, but in the half court offense, hasn't really gotten to the rim and been successful doing that. So the Wolves, and also like Jake Lehman, is more of a cutter. You know, Josh Okogie is more of a cutter than he is an actual ball handler. He's really good in transition. The Wolves don't have very many guys that can create off the dribble in the half court offense, and that's one of their issues and part of the reason why they struggled so mightily on Sunday against Dallas when their 3-point shots weren't falling. That was a major issue, was that nobody besides Russell or McLaughlin could create off the dribble. So at any rate, that's what the Wolves are looking to do. So far this season, the two of those guys, McLaughlin and Russell, have played together for 19 minutes over the course of four games. So super small sample size. But that said, in those 15 minutes, they have a net rating of 32.9. Their defensive rating is just 95.7. Offensive rating is 128.6. The assist to turnover ratio when they're on the floor together is 3.5. Effective field goal percentage as a tandem is 58%, true shooting 63%, all really good numbers. Also, in such a small sample size, it's really not worth talking about. However, I guess I'd rather it be a plus 32.9 than a negative 32.9. So they've been really good together so far this year. in those limited minutes. With the Wolves losing as it is, with Towns unavailable, it makes sense to try them together more. I'm dubious that it's going to work over long stretches, but I think depending on matchups, it makes sense for Minnesota to try it. So just an interesting note that that's something that they're definitely going to do moving forward. Also, while we're there, I was pulling these numbers in NBA.com, and one of the other little used lineups that's been successful with a couple guys who are still on the roster, Towns and Reed have played together in 9 different games, but for only a total of 10 minutes. It's almost like it's been an accident each time, right before or after Towns gets a break, and they play together, but their net rating together is 33.3. So I don't know. I think the fans that are looking for more Towns and Reed together at some point this season should get their wish at some point, because why not? Like, let's see how that might work together moving forward. I think that there could be some potential there, especially if the Wolves decide that Reed doesn't make a lot of sense as a backup center for more than short stretches, just due to some of the rebounding issues and defensive issues we've seen so far. Obviously, this is really early in an undrafted guy's rookie year, so not drawing final conclusions here, but could be fun to see them play together a little bit more here moving forward as well. All right, lastly today, we are going to talk about Wolves-Pelicans, specifically what the Pelicans have done recently, what to look out for between these two teams on Tuesday night in New Orleans. All right, diving into Wolves-Pelicans, I mentioned earlier the Wolves and Pelicans have only played once this year. That was back in December. The Wolves lost by 8. That was after New Orleans had been on, I think it was like a 13-game losing streak. 13-game losing streak. The Wolves took on the Pelicans. Of course, the Pelicans didn't have Zion Williamson at the time. He was still out with his knee injury. Take a look at who played for the Wolves in that game. There's exactly one player who appeared in that loss to the Pelicans who is still on the Timberwolves. One player. Jarrett Culver missed the game flu-like symptoms. This was towards the beginning of Towns sitting out with a sprained knee. The only player that suited up for the Wolves in that game that's still on the team is Josh Okogie. He started that game. The other guys, Andrew Wiggins, Gorgui Dieng, Jeff Teague, Trevion Graham, all started. The bench was Robert Covington. I'm not sure why he came off the bench in that game. Jordan Bell, Noah Vonleh, Kata Bates-Diop, and Shabazz Napier. All gone, all traded away, and only Okogie remains. And Okogie was arguably the worst player for the Wolves in that game. He had 3 points on 1 of 7 shooting. But really not worth talking about what the Wolves did offensively in that game, because the guys aren't the same guys. The Pelicans only scored 107, so the Wolves' defense wasn't awful in this one. New Orleans did get to the line 21 times and made 17 of their free throw attempts, which is a little bit, you know, looking at what they do as a team, that's a little bit out of character for the non-Zion Williamson players. They don't shoot a ton of free throws, and when they get to the line, they don't really make them at a high clip. They're actually below the Wolves in terms of free throw percentage on the season. Of course, both teams are completely different now than they were just 2.5 months ago. It's weird that it's been so long, you know, such a long gap in playing a Western Conference opponent, I guess, but both teams are extremely different. Taking a step back, the Pelicans so far with Zion Williamson on the floor are 8-7. Remember, they started the year pretty terribly. They had that 12-game losing streak, which seems crazy when you realize the Wolves have had an 11-game and a 13-game losing streak so far this season. And this loss was actually, for the Wolves back in December, was at the very beginning of their first really long losing streak. For this game, in terms of injuries, obviously Karl Anthony Towns is still out. He should be re-evaluated towards the end of this week. Over the weekend would be that 2-week mark that the Wolves had discussed as a team. JJ Redick will miss the game for the Pelicans. That's their one significant injury from a guy who's a big part of the rotation and a big part of what they do in terms of shooting threes. So he will be out in this game with a strained hamstring. And I mean, those are really the only major injuries. In terms of what the Pelicans have done lately, again, 8-7 with Zion on the floor. Their last time out, they lost to the Lakers by 8. They were mostly competitive. Actually, only they were up by 2 headed to the fourth quarter before the Lakers kind of put the pedal to the metal there. LeBron had a huge game. Kyle Kuzma had a really good game as well. As far as what the Pelicans did as a team, Zion had a career-high 35 points. Last time out, he shot 12 of 16 from the floor, ultra efficient, which is, I guess, probably the best way to describe him so far as a pro. 11 of 13 from the free throw line, didn't attempt a three-pointer, 7 rebounds. He did have 6 turnovers in the game. If you look at his game log, super weird. He hasn't attempted a three in the last 3 games. In fact, overall for his NBA career, he's played in 15 games and he hasn't attempted a three in 7 of them. So he's only attempted threes in 8 of his 15 games. And in only 2 of his 15 games has he attempted multiple three-pointers. His very first game, he was 4 of 4 on three-point attempts. He had one other game, he was 0 of 3. So if you take out his first game, the first NBA game of his career, regular season NBA game, since then, he's 1 of 8 from beyond the arc. 4 of 4 in the first game, 1 of 8 from beyond the arc since then. Just hasn't shot threes, doesn't need to. And I think he realized that here pretty early on, that he's physical enough that he can get to the rim basically whenever he wants. And occasionally that leads to some sloppy play, some turnovers. Turnovers have been an issue, especially recently. He has 10 over the past 2 games. That's really been the only complaint about Zion as a pro so far. He gets the free throw line almost at will. He's only had, you know, a handful of games where he's had less than 4 or 5 free throws. Actually, one game where he's attempted less than 4 free throws. Again, last time out, 11 of 13 from the free throw line. Generally speaking, he's been really impressive. And overall, he's shooting just under 65% at the free throw line. So while he was 11 of 13 last time out, the Wolves would be better served to allow him to shoot free throws than to just bully them in the paint. He's just under 60% from the field as a pro. While he doesn't shoot threes, that opening game gives him a three-point shooting percentage of 41.7, which looks really nice. But again, that's not a major part of his game. The Wolves simply need to allow him to do some damage, put him on the free throw line, and then shut everybody else down, which obviously is easier said than done. The Pelicans still have another all-star in Brandon Ingram, who's cooled off a little bit here lately, but is having a really good season, and it is a cool story that he's broken out as he has in New Orleans. He's shooting 39% on threes for the season, just under 25 points a game. 6 rebounds, 4 assists a game. With Redick out, the only real three-point threats that the Wolves need to be concerned about are Brandon Ingram, and then off the bench, Etuan Moore and Nicolò Melli, who wasn't really part of the rotation the last time these teams played. The biggest thing, though, with the Pelicans is their offense is generally effective, and it's been improving with Zion Williamson. Their season-long numbers don't really tell the story because they played so long without Zion on the floor. But the offense is effective. It's mostly dynamic. I mean, Derek Favors, Brandon Ingram, Zion Williamson, that's a pretty good trio. Throw in Jrue Holiday. They can certainly score, and that's an impressive group. But they're extremely top-heavy. If you look at this team, they don't have much in the way of depth. The bench isn't impressive. Etuan Moore is a nice piece. Nicolò Melli can shoot a little bit. But beyond that, I mean, you're talking about Frank Jackson, you're talking about Josh Hart. Lately, Jackson Hayes, 19-year-old rookie, he had played really well early in the season. He's kind of fallen out of the rotation. He may get some run here against the Wolves just because the Wolves have struggled so much on the glass. Julio Okafor hasn't really played much lately. And Nikhil Alexander-Walker also has kind of fallen out of the rotation a little bit. So interesting to see what the Pelicans do. They should be able to play more of their bench against a team like the Wolves. It's not exactly like they're playing a playoff team against the Timberwolves. But the short bench has been somewhat effective for the Pelicans. It's just at some point the lack of depth is going to catch up with them. Despite how good they've played here lately. And of course, the Pelicans still have a lot to play for. They're only 3.5 games out of the 8th spot in the West behind Memphis. And they're tied with Portland effectively for that 9 spot right now. And actually with the Kings. So really there's 3 teams that are 3.5 back of Memphis, and San Antonio is still in the conversation too, only a half game back of them. So the Pelicans have a lot to play for. They need to keep winning. With some of their struggles recently, I'm sure that they're going to be looking to correct things, I guess, when they take on the Timberwolves, and they certainly should have the capability of doing that. All right, that's all we have for you today here at Locked On Wolves. We'll be back on Wednesday with a recap of Tuesday's game. We'll talk studs and duds. We'll break down what happened in the game and look ahead at the rest of the week as well. Thanks once again for listening to the Locked On Wolves podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Remember, the Locked On Network is your local experts on the biggest stories. Subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google, wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Locked On T-Wolves. That's at Locked On T-Wolves. Don't forget the T. Once again, I'm Ben Beacon. This is the Locked On Wolves podcast, and we'll catch you next time.